ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Luna Park that sits on the edge of Sydney Harbour wasn't the first Luna Park in Australia. Melbourne had a Luna Park that's a few decades older. And there were Luna Parks in Adelaide and Perth and Brisbane. But the one on Glenelg Beach in Adelaide went broke. So it was dismantled, packed up, and then sent to Sydney, where it was reassembled largely by workers who had just finished working on the colossal harbour bridge right next to it. Helen Pitt is back on Conversations today. Last time Helen was here, she was talking about her prize-winning book on the Sydney Opera House. And now Helen's written the history of that gargoyle that grins across the water at the House of High Culture. Luna Park's famous slogan was and is, "Just for fun." I should say I went there as a kid, as a 12-year-old. I remember that as one of the happiest nights of my young life. I was so excited by the lights, the rides, the junk food, the noise, the colour, the sense of freedom. I thought my head would explode. The Luna Park was more than just a place for kids. It was also a pleasure palace for young lovers too. Millions of people have similar happy memories of Luna Park, of walking through the teeth of that gigantic, grinning face at the entrance, of screaming as they go down the Big Dipper and dodging the unfortunate anti-gravity emissions of people on the spinning rotor. But the tale of Luna Park is also bound up with con men and crooked cops and developers who have long wanted to snatch up that prime piece of waterfront real estate. And then there's the horror of the Ghost Train fire of 1979, which took the lives of 7 people, 6 of them children. The botched investigation that followed was a terrible stain on the city's history. Luna Park was shuttered for years, but it was rebuilt, renovated, replastered and repainted, and it's recovered its original glory, and it remains to this day a deeply romantic place. Helen Pitt's book is called Luna Park, the extraordinary story of the showmen, shysters and schemers who built Sydney's famous fun park. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Richard.
I have those happy memories, like I said, of going there on a Friday night. To me, it was, looking back, I think it's my idea of what paradise was like. I think until then, you know, when people imagine heaven, they've got, you know, people in robes, it's peaceful, they're on a cloud somewhere. No, no, no. Heaven's exciting. Heaven's a bit dangerous. Heaven has a sense of freedom about it, and you can eat all the junk food you like. Do you have similar memories of going there as a kid?
Absolutely. My 8th birthday, like your visit when you were 12, was the happiest day of my life at that short point in my place on the planet. And I think you're right. The moment you just walk through that mouth, it's like a transformation into another world. It's our equivalent of Marcel Proust, you know, eating the Madeleine and instantly going back to childhood. And I don't think that matters what age you are. Like, you walk through it as an adult and you can immediately feel what it was like to be a little kid in that sense of wonder and awe. They always used to say it's the place where adults can become kids again and kids can lose their adults. And you just do go into this alternative universe of fun but also fear, and just a taste of independence was really what it was all about for all of us that went as young children, I think, as kids. And then again, it was a rite of passage as teenagers. Quite often the first place many of us went without our parents, because it was bus train ride to Circular Quay and an amazing ferry ride across the harbour. And as artist Martin Sharp always used to say, it's part of the triumvirate of Sydney, really. You know, you got the Sydney Opera House, the Sydney Harbour Bridge and Luna Park. And really, when you take that ferry and arrive that way, it's Sydney on a stick. You know, it's got the views, it's got absolutely everything you could possibly want. Sydney on a Cupid doll stick, in fact, because that's where the Summer of the 17th doll was filmed in 1958.
Yes, with Ernest Borgnine in it, of all people.
And Angela Lansbury. And yeah, just the most extraordinary backdrop. The first time Sydney really starred in a Hollywood film, the first film made with foreign money from America. So it was recognisable as one of the most startling spots in the harbour. The gold tooth in the mouth of the harbour, the Sydney Morning Herald used to call it, because it was a gold mine. But it's kind of now considered a bit more the lowbrow face of the harbour as opposed to the highbrow face at the Sydney Opera House that it looks out at.
I've got all these sense memories from that night of, like, I think it wasn't being in the cha-cha and it whizzing over the harbour, or maybe that's exaggeration, or maybe it was the wild mouse or something.
Wild mouse still does.
Yes.
And the zipper, which turns you completely upside down. You know, obviously over the generations, the rides have changed. In fact, the rotor is currently on the right-hand side when you walk through. When I was a kid, it was on the left-hand side, and it was always the place where more people lost their lunch than any other part of the park.
I never went on the rotor, because the other kids were saying, don't go on the rotor because people spew and it hangs in midair and then splashes onto you. Is that true?
Yes, and in fact,
really?
We're not allowed to call it vomit at the park. We call it a protein spill because it happens so regularly. We do not like to embarrass the patrons who do lose their lunch, so they quickly change your clothes, launder them, and it's as if nothing has ever happened. Yes.
Protein spill. Is there like a protein spill on the rotor? Is
that precisely really like that? That's exactly how it happens, and it's very well efficiently handled today as it was back then too.
When you were going through there at the age of 8 with your dad, what was your dad like on that trip?
My dad completely lit up. So it turns out, I didn't know when I was writing this book, you know, I was just writing a book about another Sydney Harbour icon across the bridge from the Opera House, that my dad had gone as a 9-year-old with his elder brother, Fred. He was 20 years younger than his elder brother. And Uncle Fred, I always knew, had worked on the Big Dipper, but I didn't know he'd actually built it. So this was an extraordinary story I found from my cousin. So he was one of the unemployed workers in Depression-era Sydney who lined up at the front to get work. So he was a mechanic. He ended up working on the Big Dipper, testing it. And so he really wanted to take his younger brother to test it out as a 9-year-old. And Dad, even when he took me as an 8-year-old, just lit up at the face of all my friends running on to go on the turkey trot and the joy wheel and the barrels of fun. But we were all a bit frightened to go down the slide, so he induced us by walking up the stairs with us and getting the Hessian sack out and pushing us off, and then you couldn't stop us. We even gamed the Devil's Drop, which is an even steeper slide. And just when I think back then, that sensation of the wind flying through your hair, then the absolute freedom, you just can't help but laugh. I mean, Coney Island today is still a time capsule of how it was in 1935 when the park opened. So is this real walk down memory lane to your own childhood and many, many generations of others?
Now, to find the origins of the urban amusement park, you go all the way back to the 1893 World Expo in Chicago, where Chicago's response to the Eiffel Tower was to build a gigantic Ferris wheel. What kind of an impact did this prototype amusement park make?
Chicago's World Fair changed the face of the world, created the blueprint for the modern day amusement park. As you said, the idea was to out-Eiffel Eiffel and his impermanent Eiffel Tower. So they built this giant Ferris wheel that was the centrepiece of the world's Columbian Fair in 1893. Now, it laid the groundwork in many ways. It created this thing called the Midway Plaisance. It was Chicago's like big attempt to show the rest of the world of how big an important city it was. So the Midway is a term used in every amusement park now. It's that centre line that goes through all amusement parks.
Like an esplanade.
An esplanade of usually asphalt and fun, sometimes a little bit of vomit occasionally, but certainly wherever you find an amusement park, the workers that will call it Midway. And so that was what began the whole amusement park movement. Now, 1893, there's this a group of people that come to start rides and start entertainment, and one of them happened to be a young architect by the name of Fred Thompson, who gave up his promising career as an architectural draftsman and an inventor to become the janitor at a ride on the Midway. And from that, he learned absolutely everything you needed to know about going to fairs. So he took rides to the Buffalo World's Fair, and he took them all over the country. And in doing so, he met another entrepreneur who was perhaps more of a business mind by the name of Elmer Skip Dundee. Skippio was his middle name. And together they teamed to start a whole load of different rides that appeared in loads of different fairs at this stage. So The pages of Jules Verne's 1865 novel, From the Earth to the Moon, may have inspired modern-day moon missions, but they also inspired this young guy called Fred Thompson. And it's important to remember, Richard, at that time, at the turn of the century, everyone was captured by this idea of travel into space. So he created this ride called A Trip to the Moon in 1901 at the Buffalo World's Fair there.
And what would people experience when they went on this ride?
Well, it was pretty rudimentary, but it was like a kayak or a wooden vessel that flew up into the sky, and you could look out the porthole and see sights of America, like Niagara Falls that you were flying, and then suddenly you looked out and you were into outer space. And the idea is when you arrived, you stepped out and you were served green cheese, according to the prevailing myth at the time that the moon was made of green cheese. And it was served by dwarves that the two of them had met at the Chicago World's Fair.
Oompa
again,
Loompas, wow.
Exactly, kind of a bit like the Wizard of Oz, who Boehm, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, had actually attended Chicago's World Fair. So the World Fair changed America in so many ways. From it invented chewing gum, it invented the escalator, it invented the modern-day amusement park.
So Fred Thompson and his partner Skip Lundy then built the first lunar park in New York on Long Island, Coney Island, just on the southern part of Long Island in New York. How did they arrive at the name Lunar Park? Because it's not quite what I thought it was going to be. Because I just assumed it was say with the moon and lunacy and lunatics and all, and this is a place where you go crazy. That's not quite the origin, though, is it?
It's a surprise. Like you would think, wouldn't you, given this ride is called A Trip to the Moon, the airship's called Luna, that would be indeed why they called their permanent park Lunar Park. What happened was they were enticed to New York by a guy called George Tillieu, who'd ridden the Ferris wheel in Chicago and said, I want this and I want a ride like A Trip to the Moon that he'd seen at Buffalo's World Fair. So he enticed them down in 1902, and that first season they did very well on that ride, A Trip to the Moon, but they wanted their own park because they didn't want to give the profits to Tillieu, who was the one who invented the very first face entry. Steeplechase Funny Face is the motto for that park, and his face was above the entry spot. So Dundee and Thompson started their own amusement park next door, Lunar Park, not named for the airship, not named for their ride, but Skip's youngest sister was called Luna Dundee, and she was a world champion whist player who lived not very far away. At 37, not very well known to the rest of the world, but everyone assumed that it was named for the moon, but no, it was for his younger sister. And you find that in her obituary that was written, sadly, only 3 years after the park opened because she died at 40.
So the first lunar park established in Australia by a couple of American entrepreneurs in Melbourne, that's the same lunar park that's still there today in St Kilda Beach?
It's amazing. It is, yes. And it's not really had much closure other than it closed in World War One.
So in 1913, the chief engineer of Melbourne's lunar park, T.H. Eslick, moved to Sydney to set up a flashy amusement park, not on the harbour, but, well, close to the harbour, in Sydney's Rushcutters Bay, right next to King's Cross, that he called White City after the Chicago Expo. Lasted 3 years, then what happened to this amusement park, White City?
Well, like many amusement parks all over the world, it was destroyed by a terrible storm, and which ended up becoming a fire. But T.H. Eslick was quite the character. He had been involved in the creation of lunar parks all over Europe. And White City also was another popular name. There were white cities all over the world. And this one in particular, he'd chosen to be around Rushcutters Bay in Paddington, and he actually ran for the local seat of Paddington as a politician, didn't win the seat. So he had great political ambitions. I think you'd probably call him a businessman along the lines of Christopher Skase these days, in that
right.
He would start up these schemes and then
well,
they
crook.
Would fail.
Right, right.
And then
yeah.
He wouldn't be able to return to the place that he came because he had a health issue that would prevented him from returning
He's
to
in
Brisbane.
The wheelchair, the oxygen
yes.
mask, all of that.
He had osteoarthritis
right.
and funny, he could fly to America, but he couldn't fly back to Brisbane where he had creditors. So
okay, so he skipped town, did he?
But skipped town.
But is that White City amusement park the same White City tennis centre that's there now?
Precisely, it is, yes. It's where the name comes from.
And that gets its name from the White City of Chicago,
precisely.
The White City amusement park in Chicago.
And interestingly, there was a White City also in Perth. So there was a white city in Sydney and a white city in Perth, and it was shut down, the one in Perth, because the snake charmer, Cleopatra, got bitten by one of her venomous vapours and died. So
just like Cleopatra.
Snake charmers, and then there was boxing and illegal gambling, which actually shut the one in Perth.
Then 1935, Adelaide got its own Luna Park at Glenelg Beach. A lovely beach. You could just get on the tram at Victoria Square in the middle of Adelaide, takes you right there, seemed to have everything going for it. Why didn't Luna Park succeed in Adelaide?
Well, the Depression bit into its profits. The owners asked for a rent reduction from Glenelg Town Council. They were denied that. But then also they asked for permission to open on Sundays. Now, there were strict laws preventing South Australian businesses trading on a Sunday.
In general, in Adelaide in those days, there was a bit of a no-riff-raff sign hanging on the
Precisely.
City limits too as well, wasn't there? Was
the
that
Glenelg,
an issue?
Yep, absolutely. They did not like the characters that came there. That was definitely questionable characters that hung out there. So that is one of the reasons why it failed. They packed it all up in 1934, put it to auction, but there were no buyers. So the Phillips brothers decided, okay, what are we going to do? In conjunction with David Atkins and a young Tasmanian engineer that had started the same week that the park opened, called Ted Hopkins, they took careful plans and dismantled everything and put it all in a steamship, 1,300 tons of fun, all the rides like the Big Dipper.
The Big Dipper was there in Adelaide?
The Big Dipper was there, the Noah's Ark, a whole load of rides that were part of that very first Luna Park.
Right, dismantled and put onto a steamship?
Piece by piece, right. Bolt by bolt, put together. Very careful pictures were made for their reassembly when they came to Sydney, and they packed it up. And what happened was the Phillips brothers said, well, we better find somewhere else. Why don't we go to Sin City, Sydney? David, you've been working in Coogee. Could you find us preferably a beachside suburb that would be at the end of a tram or train line that we could set up? Now, because of the failure of White City, and there was another amusement park in Waverley Council area at Tamarama called Wonderland City that was only briefly there, but it absolutely irked the locals, particularly the Tamarama Surf Life Saving Club, because it took up prized beachfront area, only left 4 metres of the beach. And its main ride, the Arum Scarum, kept breaking down. So there was a lot of resistance in the beachside suburbs for an amusement park in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. So he traipsed all around Sydney and found this 5-acre lot on the former warehouses, the site where, as you said, the Harbour Bridge was put together, the workshops. It was completely dismantled. It was just a set of, like, weeds and old bricks. And so the Phillips brothers signed a lease of agreement with the Department of Main Roads, who owned the land at that time, and Bob's your uncle.
So this was this incredibly lucky confluence of circumstances. One, there was the Great Depression, which meant that there wasn't the kind of insane real estate demand. Then there was the fact that there were all those sheds there built for the workers on the Harbour Bridge. So, my God, they've got this incredible waterfront site, which is probably worth more than quite a lot of nations.
Absolutely.
These days.
You can imagine, can't you? Like, it was not paying its way, the Harbour Bridge. So they needed to find ways to get people to come to the north side because everyone was going to the city. So the local North Sydney Council and New South Wales government teamed together to do these twin projects, the North Sydney Olympic Pool and the amusement park. So they were both begun in 1935.
So the giant face that now stands or has traditionally stood at the entrance of Sydney's Luna Park, was that in Adelaide and brought over, or did they make one fresh?
No, they made a brand new one. There was no face in Adelaide. There was only the face in Melbourne. It was quite a sinister-looking Mr. Moon, and this was also a very sinister-looking, the first one, made by Rupert Brown, the first scenic artist in Melbourne. He was brought up to Sydney, and it didn't last very long because it was, you know, paper mache and canvas and horsehair and all sorts of things. It was slapped together very quickly. So once they moved all the rides and unloaded them at that very same wharf that had been the place where all the activity had taken place for the Harbour Bridge, all the workers came and Depression era lined up. And, you know, it's quite remarkable that given it's one of the three icons of Sydney, The Harbour Bridge was built in 8 years. The Sydney Opera House was built in 16 years. This took 3 months, 12 weeks of non-stop work. And there you go. It remains glittering by the ocean now. It's quite hard to believe.
So on October the 4th, 1935, someone threw the switch and all the 900 million lights of Luna Park went on. Was it an instant hit, Luna Park?
Instant hit, yes. People were there that night, and then all the local kids were let in for free the next day. And I interviewed one of them, Patty Harbert, bless her, who died the same month that Luna Park celebrated its 90th. But it, again, like us both, it was a standout memory of her childhood. She just loved every minute of it.
What did she remember of that?
Oh, she could remember the rides, running through with her brother, holding his hand, being given the tickets, and just the sheer joy, because this is a kid of the Depression. She'd never had anything like it. And she also particularly remembered the box of airplane jelly she got given as a freebie. It never made it home. It was meant to go home to the families. But, you know, she licked her finger and stuck it into the jelly crystals and ate it well before it got home. So this is so interesting. Every time I talk to someone that went to Luna Park as a child, they always have these beautiful memories that just put a smile on their face.
She remembered going on that ride, the River Caves. Was that like a kind of a tunnel of love type ride?
It was. And in fact, Martin Sharp, the artist, again, used to say, you know, the Big Dipper is a bit like an extension of the Harbour Bridge. The River Caves was like an extension of the ferry that you take to get to Luna Park. And you went through these nine dioramas, nine different worlds. There was Tarzan and Jane, there were Eskimos, there were Aborigines, there was a Japanese tea house. There were all different worlds. And at that time, the River Caves came from Adelaide. It was packed up and brought from Adelaide. So it was very much like the great museums in New York, the dioramas that took people around the world before world travel, international travel was possible. So they really took people to other places, and not to mention the Big Dipper, which was just a thrill right on the edge of Sydney Harbour.
Were there complaints from the good folk of North Sydney about all the riffraff coming into Luna Park after it opened?
There were before it opened, but very cleverly, Ted Hopkins, who was a very fine photographer, befriended the local Reverend Frank Cash, who was also a very good photographer, who'd taken photos daily of the Harbour Bridge being built. And so he threw a lot of money at the church fate, and funnily enough, the churches did not complain. Although at the beginning, before they came, the local Anglican minister thought there would be orgies every night, but that kind of did end up happening in World War II, when there ended up being a bit of a dark side to Luna Park, when a lot of soldiers went there and prostitutes gathered under the pylons of the Harbour Bridge. But, you know, it was an instant success, and that's largely because kids of all ages went there constantly.
Ted Hopkins, you mentioned there, one of the founding fathers of Luna Park, became a local identity. What kind of a man was this Ted Hopkins?
I think he was a pretty happy old soul. In fact, they say that the Arthur Barton face that's there currently was based on Old King Cole, but that it's kind of Ted Hopkins' face. He was a ruddy-complexioned, white-haired man they called the White Cloud. And between he and DA, David Atkins, they were known as the Laurel and Hardy team. So they were the driving force behind the park. His theory was that every kid that comes should not leave empty-handed. So he always made sure that there were toys kids could take home, and that they had they left with a big smile on their faces, and that way they would just beg their parents to take them back each time. So he was known so much, such an identity, he's known as Mr. Luna Park. And in fact, his ashes are scattered beside the wharf upon which he unloaded the rides.
How did Sydney's Luna Park change once World War II arrived and we got into the war in the Pacific and we have a whole lot of American servicemen coming to Australia? How did that change things?
Yeah, well, it did become very much an adult playground. You know, there was the Fred Switely band that was a swing band. They used the Palais dance floor, which was the old pontoon that had been used for the ferries, and it was a really popular place that many soldiers and sailors spent their final night at before going to a theatre of war. So it really changed from being a childhood pleasure palace to an adult and young person place, and very popular. Even through the wartime, that was the case. Even in the 60s, you know, they had go-go dancers that came to Coney Island. So it was quite often an adult theme park as well as one for children.
What happened the night when those Japanese subs midget subs came into Sydney Harbour and started firing off torpedoes?
Yes, well, fascinating. Amazingly, Luna Park remained open during World War II. It was going to be requisitioned by the army, but then Ted Hopkins said he could see that the government could see there was a very valid point of giving people an escape from their wartime woes. So it remained, it was browned out, but then they escaped when they heard about the Japanese subs into a little air raid shelter that had been a remnant of the Dorman Long site when it was the place that the harbour bridge had been built. It was the place where all the explosives were kept. It was a little dugout hole in the sandstone at Milsons Point. It's still there today, and everyone who was working that night took refuge and hid from the Japanese subs.
The last remaining founder of Luna Park, Ted Hopkins, that we talked about a bit earlier, said this lovely thing in 1960. He said, "If you could bottle the scent of childhood, it would be the vanilla essence in the waffles sold at Luna Park." The food at Luna Park, I remember that being a big thing for me. None of it was good for me. All of it was bad for me at the time. But, man, it's delicious to a kid, isn't it?
Oh, can't you just taste it? The Dagwood dogs and the smell of the popcorn and the fairy floss, which he always insisted had to be made in front of you. None of this stuff from a bag. And hot dogs were actually invented in Coney Island. You know, they say Coney Island and hot dogs go together since hot dog first met bun. It's been part of the joy is the junk food, to be honest, because, again, you've got the freedom to choose what you want to eat, usually.
That's right. You're not at home. You are going to eat all that rubbishy food and have a marvellous time with it.
So Ted really understood that. So smells are as important a part of childhood and those rides as the feeling and the sensation you get when you're on the rides.
And the theatre of whipping up the fairy floss too. Not in a bag. It had to be done in front of you.
Absolutely. And most of the nights that Luna Park was open, there was a bigger staff at night than there was in the daytime. It was the daytime when maintenance people. It also shut during the winter. So it was only a summer thing from September, October to May. So it was quite a sunny, happy time and pleasant evenings to be out there. So it was all part of the theatre of the park.
After the war, Prince Philip came to visit Sydney and had a visit to Luna Park. How did he get on in Luna Park?
Well, he had a ball in the barrel of fun. He fell over and he actually made the front page of the Daily Telegraph. But he also went for a ride on the river caves and stood up and was escorted off the ride. Ha! But he was sort of
really?
Just... Yes, he was only Prince Philip of Greece at that time. So he wasn't particularly well known as, you know, the wife of the Queen Elizabeth II. But it was the sort of place that people wanted to go to when Alfred Hitchcock visited Sydney. He went to Luna Park. When famous people came, they'd heard about it because it was a very American-style thing. Particularly people from America came. That's why it was so popular with servicemen, because they saw, oh, there's a Coney Island here. Well, we must go to that too.
By the 1960s, Luna Park was getting a little bit quaint, which might be the death knell, funnily enough, for an amusement park. So it brought in a new ride called the Wild Mouse in 1963. How was that different from the Big Dipper?
Well, it was modelled on one that Ted Hopkins had seen overseas, and he always just got the idea, got the patient for it, and would make it himself when he got home. Got the ideas, got the plans, and put it together from the German plan. So it was terribly scary, and it still is terribly scary, if you ask me, the Wild Mouse, because it goes out over the harbour, and it's similar to the Big Dipper, but just slightly more contained in that there's a little cars. So the thing is, he would travel all through the winter months in the summer season in the Northern Hemisphere and bring back great rides. That's how the Rota came back from Germany. He was always trying to find inventive ways to bring new things to Sydney, and that was the appeal, because it was like cutting-edge technology in that time. But you're right, it was starting to get slightly run down by the late 60s.
By 1970, it was getting a bit long in the tooth, and there was talk about shuttering Luna Park and replacing it with a World Trade Centre.
Well, indeed.
Seriously?
Absolutely. So the lease was being operated by Hopkins, and he did not take up the lease renewal. So Nathan Spatt and Leon Fink took up that, And the first thing that they wanted to do was put in a $50 million World Trade Center that Harry Seidler did the plans for. The Ascan government knocked it back remarkably. And then it wasn't the last time that was attempted, though. That was also, again, many years later when Barry Unsworth was premier, that they wanted to make it an adult theme park, again, high rise. And there was talk at one point that Club Med might be involved in that too. So this has been prized harbourside real estate. So it is remarkable that it hasn't had any high rise on it. It remained. But by the late 60s, early 70s, it was getting a bit long in the tooth, that is for sure. And the lease was only on a week-to-week contract. So Leon Fink invited in some artists like Martin Sharp, Peter Kingston, Gary Shedd, Richard Liney, pop artists that did a new face to match the times, the 1970s, and painted it in different colours and so forth. But it was starting to get slightly run down by this stage.
What effect did working on Luna Park have on the young Martin Sharp, who was becoming a world-famous artist at the time, creating posters and covers of Oz magazine and the like? What effect did it have on him?
I think it would be fair to say he was quite obsessed with it. He invited his friend Tiny Tim to break the world singing record at Luna Park in 1979, which in fact he did. I think he loved how it transported you to childhood. He always felt that it was a microcosm of Sydney, and he just loved it like nothing else. And he convinced his friend Peter Kingston, who by this stage had bought a house next door to the park, to become involved with maintaining it. And I think he kind of never let go of his obsession with it all through his days.
Then on the 25th of July, 1974, Helen, Sydneysiders woke up to be told in the paper that six of the giant face's teeth were missing. This was a great scandal and a mystery at the time. Newspapers said the theft was obviously the work of professionals. You've got the scoop here, Helen. What the hell happened to those missing teeth?
Well, it was actually quite common for them to be blacked out for muck-up day, say, back in the 70s and 80s, but these were actually teeth taken from the face. And it turns out that they were University of New South Wales pranksters that were part of the uni scavenger hunt that came down there one night, thought they only... Part of the list was you had to get a condom machine from Sydney Uni, a tooth from Luna Park. They not only got one, they got six teeth, threw them in the Fielder's Bread getaway truck and raced back to Kensington, jumping over the medium strip to avoid paying the toll on the Harbour Bridge. And when they got
They went over the median strip on the Harbour Bridge?
It was like a complete getaway vehicle. Now, I cannot reveal the name of these people because to this day, they do not want to be known. And they unloaded their loot on the green at the University of New South Wales. And the poor old student union that was actually the one overseeing the scavenger hunt then has to reveal the fact that they are the ones in possession of these teeth when it's on the front pages of the newspapers and leading the TV bulletins. And one of the guys whose mother came to visit him from Wollongong, she comes and sits on the bed and goes, "Did you hear that they've stolen Luna Park's teeth?" And goes, "Mum, you're sitting on one of them. It's under my bed." So he had to fess up. Although the poor old union were the ones that returned it, the actual culprits ended up becoming some of the best medicos in New South Wales, not only doctors but dentists, and it was perhaps the first and last tooth extraction they ever performed for free.
Fantastic. They won't reveal their identities even
not
now?
Even nearly over 50 years later.
Are they still proud of themselves for having done this?
They are, they wouldn't have told me otherwise.
Right. Maybe they reveal these sorts of things after the ninth glass of wine at a dinner party somewhere or something, but there we are.
Exactly.
Now we move to the most grim episode in the history of Luna Park, the horror of the night of Saturday the 9th of June 1979, and around about 10:14 that night, you record that the fire brigade were called to Luna Park. They could see the blaze coming over the Harbour Bridge. How bad was it once the fire brigade arrived at the ghost train?
Things were pretty bad. You know, I interviewed firemen that were there that night, the surviving boy from Waverley College who was there that night. Four boys from Waverley College and a father with his two young sons were killed in this fire. It went up like tinderbox because obviously it was paper mache and old school wood, and it just burnt extraordinarily quickly. And no matter how many fire brigades that came from all over Sydney, there were about 12, they couldn't get the water pressure to stop the fire. Hoses were not working properly. There was no sprinkler system in the ride, and things went from bad to worse by the time everyone came to the park to see what was happening. People were streaming out. The fire engines went through the mouth to get in, but there were so many people coming out. It was very dangerous. And I think we all know, any of us that were Sydneysiders that age would be marked by that night, because it was a real black night in the history of the city.
I just can't imagine the frustration of the firefighters. They've got this substandard equipment. They haven't got any water pressure. They had to draw water from Sydney Harbour.
They did, yeah. They had to draw water from the harbour. And by that stage, you know, it took too long to put the fire out. So they knew that there was very little hope for anyone that may have been in that building.
And what did they find when they went through the debris?
Terrible, terrible, like, scattering of bodies that were unrecognisable, that was so unrecognisable as humans that they sometimes thought they might have been mannequins in the ride. So it's a terrible, terrible night.
The lead investigator, Detective Inspector Doug Knight, arrived at the scene and very quickly declared that the fire had been caused by an electric fault. Did he have any expertise in this matter?
No, he was not a forensics
expert. Was there any evidence for this at all?
No, he's not a forensics expert, he's not an arson expert or anything like that. Declared it very quickly. And the whole site was bulldozed with indecent haste, way too quickly. This would never happen today, because we don't know actually if it was an accident or arson. We didn't know back then.
But so it was bulldozed within a couple of days. So no,
within 24 hours.
24 hours.
Yes.
So no evidence could be retrieved.
No
after that.
Evidence, and that is the very heart of the problem. There is no evidence either way.
The coroner returned an open finding, and the coroner said the probable cause was a tossed cigarette or a match. Well, that's possible, I suppose. But was there any evidence to suggest that might have happened?
Well,
or
no,
it was just pure speculation?
There was not. The thing to remember is it was cracker night, which was a very important thing in, you know, Australia in that time. A stray firework could have been there, or a deliberate firework could have been there. It could have been kerosene lighting. We don't know.
Several witnesses reported they'd smelt kerosene that night.
Yes.
One witness said he'd overheard a group of bikies near the ghost train talking about spreading kero throughout the ride and lighting it up. How much of this testimony was taken into the inquiry?
None, very little, because of the 80 witnesses that were meant to appear at the inquest, very few, actually, I think it was like under 30, actually gave evidence. I don't know why. It was a different era. And after that, a National Crimes Authority report found that both the inquest and the investigation were both severely inadequate. So we've had several investigations thereafter, and no one has ever come to a probable cause.
Detective Inspector Doug Knight, that I mentioned earlier, turned out to be an interesting character. Tell me about him.
Well, he answered to Bill Allen, who is one of the police commissioners that ended up in jail. Like, I think it's pretty common knowledge amongst anyone that was in Sydney at that time that the cops were pretty crooked. You know, the police reporters I interviewed that were there that night, interestingly, they have never been called up to give evidence in any of these subsequent investigations since. That everyone knew the cops were crooked. Now, who they were protecting, I don't know. We may never know. But there's questions that remain. And at this point, even the families who lost children there, there's questions as to whether or not is it worthwhile having another inquest to go through the embers of their grief again? Is it worthwhile? I don't know. But there's so many answers that are not given.
Doug Knight was later found to be corrupt and to have links to Abe Saffron, who was known at the time as, quote, a colourful Sydney businessman, the King of King's Cross. What was Abe Saffron's interest in the Luna Park site?
Well, this NCA report said that he'd coveted the site for 20 years. Now, once we don't know why, Neville Wran, the Premier at the time, would not grant a long-term lease to Leon Fink and his partner Nathan Spatt. What we do know is when the park did reopen, the Goldstein brothers got the lease, and they are actually Abe Saffron's cousin, and his nephew actually ended up being responsible for the accounting of the park. So we don't know. Is the name has been linked, Abe Saffron's name's been linked to that Luna Park fire for as almost as soon as it happened, and Martin Sharp is one of the first to put two and two together, which is why I think he became obsessed with it. He called his friend the night of the fire and immediately suspicious. I don't know. I wish I knew. I wish I had some answers. If there's anyone out there that knows, please tell us, because it's one of those unsolved mysteries, which is at the heart of this book and maybe one of the reasons why I wrote it, because as much as a place of fun it is, it's also a huge place of sadness for me and my generation of Sydneysiders.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the impact it had on the people of Sydney, that disaster, the overwhelming grief and a feeling that something really beautiful had been tainted. Martin Sharp, you mentioned there, he kind of saw it in spiritual terms, didn't he? He saw it as like he actually believed that something evil had invaded that palace of innocence and fun that night.
Yes, and he did become quite obsessed with this whole sort of avenue of investigation, an occult link, all sorts of things that he went down.
There were strange figures dressed in occult costumes around the park that night too, which is really odd.
Well, what happened was they were actually at Circular Quay, and that was on the front page of the Sun newspaper, and the boys, the Godson boys, were photographed with them before they got on the ferry there. So there's so many lingering mysteries that came out many years after the park. And people forget, you know, it closed immediately after the fire, the day after, and it was closed on and off for 17 years. So this laid an open space for lots of gossip and controversy about what actually happened, because it was just this sad, sad place, this sad face. And even people forget that the harbour was without a Luna Park face for 7 years. So that was quite some time. And one of the remarkable stories is the protest movement that Martin Sharp formed with his friend Peter Kingston to save the park. And we really have that band of merry artists and the various other people, like architects like Sam Marshall and various other people, that banded together to fight for the cause of saving Luna Park.
How much of an achievement was that? Because there was a lot of talk about demolishing the site and turning it into a casino. Block of apartments, because that's the kind of imagination a lot of people have for such places, oh, a casino or a block of apartments. For a protest movement to stand in the way of property developers seeing a gigantic bucket of money like that, it's quite a heroic achievement.
It was absolutely heroic. And you've got to look back at it as one of the greatest accomplishments of the urban environmental movement in Sydney. They had protests. They had mental as anything plays, something is missing. They had people walk across the Harbour Bridge to Macquarie Street. They had people dressed as Luna Park costume people. They really captured the imagination of Sydney, and people just wanted to say, hands off our childhood. This is a really important place. So it is really quite remarkable that this protest movement was listened to. And so the first time it reopened in 1982 as the Harbourside Amusement Parlour, and that was from 82 to 88. But then it closed again. And so they had to sort of dust off the mothballs and come out again and fight to save Luna Park. And the remarkable thing about that was the time when it was going to be turned into an adult amusement park with high rise again. And then the government gave the operators a deadline in 1990 and said, if you're not going to keep it as an amusement park, you cannot have the lease. Well, they defaulted on the lease. And this amazing thing came out of that in the Luna Park Site Act of 1990. It's extraordinary. It is one of only two amusement parks in the world that must remain an amusement park. So it was set in legislation thereafter that if you're going to take this lease, you have to do what the people of Sydney want to do with it, and that is for it to remain an amusement park.
It was painstakingly renovated, revived, brought back to its original glory, but then it had to close down yet again over legal action led by the architect Harry Seidler over the Big Dipper. What was the controversy there?
Well, we know in New South Wales and Australia we call that sort of protesting NIMBYism, not in my backyard. In this case, the residents of Milsons Point, it was NUMBYism, not under my balcony, in that this new set of owners in the 90s, we forget that the park was pretty much closed for only 13 months of the 90s. So when it was being reopened in 1995, I didn't really consult. It was run by a Luna Park Trust. They were in conjunction with Whittingslow's amusement park that had run Moomba Festival. So they put in the Southern Hemisphere's biggest Big Dipper. Now, in hindsight, it's kind of ill-advised because it did go right by the sight lines of Harry Seidler's office and home, as well as all the other neighbours. It was way too big for the site compared to the old Big Dipper, which had to be demolished after the fire. So it was perhaps not the best consultation with the neighbours. So they eventually banded together and took it to the Supreme Court, which impacted the number of hours the Big Dipper could operate. So it could only operate on a Friday and Saturday night, which made it financially unviable. So the park had to shut 13 months just after it opened again.
But, you know, I get that this thing had become, the Big Dipper had become much bigger and much noisier too. And I guess, you know, people have a right to quiet enjoyment of their property, I think. But at the time, I remember it was seen as yet another example in the 90s of rich old people using the money and power they have to crack down on the pleasure of young people. This was happening right across Sydney at the time. Pubs that had bands were being shut under noise complaints. They wanted to have the quiet of a North Shore library there. What do you think
Look,
about all that,
yeah,
Helen?
Absolutely. Why would you live near an amusement park if you didn't like the sound of children?
I know. I also think sometimes the sight of something so gloriously Art Deco offended the modernists' aesthetic sensibilities of Harry Seidler.
Yes.
It was like modernism versus Art Deco, and modernism brutalism won.
Quite possibly. I mean, the point is, it was a childhood venue of just delight for so many people. And so it did seem very mean on their part to do this. And court case after court case has happened thereafter as well. But that's, again, it's just a remarkable rollercoaster story in that you think, okay, surely it's not going to survive. Then it does. And when it shut in 1996, I think people really thought that this is really curtains. And then, of course, remarkably, Sydney wins the Olympic Games. And so suddenly it's, oh, actually, maybe this is a pretty good spot. Maybe we should look at it reopened in time for the Sydney Olympics, just briefly. And then new owners that banded together in, to bid for it in the late 90s were very experienced entertainers. So Peter Hearn had run the Annandale and the Hopetown Pub, like sites of live music, and his partner Warwick Doughty ran Demtel. But wait, there's more, and we'll throw in a free set of steak knives. And their idea for rebidding for this was to turn it into the North Sides Metro Theatre for live music venues. And so they won the contract by teaming with Michael Edgley, the former circus entrepreneur, and Metro Multiplex, which promised to build some corporate offices for Luna Park right beside it. And together, they banded together to convince the government that they were the right people. And I think they actually were. They had worked in pubs and knew all the sort of ins and outs of the law. But they needed to do so much renovation work because, of course, by this stage, it's recognised for its heritage value. So everything has to be painstakingly restored. That means getting rid of all the asbestos of the old rides and of the old buildings had to be restored. A lot of the original stuff had sadly been sold at auction, which broke Ted Hopkins' heart in 1981 because it was
the old carousel.
Yes, the carousel got sold for $140,000 and shipped to America. And then Martin Sharp gets to at the auction where they're auctioning off Coney Island and all its rides, and Martin convinced his mother to buy the Turkey Trot and all the rides in there. Amazingly, they remained. They remained on site. So we still have them there, and we have Martin to thank and his mother for giving them money to making sure that they're there still. So, again, I just think they thought, there's just no way it's going to reopen again. So when these new owners came with renewed enthusiasm and renewed money, they remarkably cleaned up the place and it's been open ever since, but for COVID.
I took my daughter there when she was little and I was readying myself for a bit of heartbreak or something, or to see a very different place. But there was so much there that I remembered from my childhood, particularly in the Coney Island exhibit at the back. So much of the original park was sort of gleaming and revived and really beautiful. I was really quite surprised and moved and delighted by that. What's it like for you today to walk down?
Oh, look, I love going there still. It still brings a big smile to my face. You know, I can feel that feeling of not just my own, but I see I'm around children that are there and they are so in love with the place that they kind of run to the towers and hug them because they're so excited and all they're clinging to the gate waiting for it to open.
And the idea that you enter that park by going through its digestive system is gloriously disgusting, I think.
It is. It is. Because your digestive system is often upset by going on some of the rides too. But you're right. It's just this lovely moment of seeing kids enjoying it there still. And, you know, they've also had to reacquaint themselves with how people have fun these days. So the big top was to bring music into the park. And now what the current management have done is teamed with Netflix. So they've got immersive experiences from both Squid Games and Stranger Things. So they're sort of like catering to digital natives. It will always have that young kids desperate to meet the height requirement to go on some of the rides, so desperate that they'll stack their shoes with socks and inner soles to make sure that they reach the height limit. You'll always have that, and then you'll have grandparents that want to take their children there and parents that want to take their children there to relive their youth. But it does have to look at different ways for it to survive. So it is and will always be an amusement park by the sea now. It has to be. But they've got to look at new ways to survive. It's a business. So the Luna Park Site Act means that it really must remain an amusement park. So it's protected by government legislation. Aren't we lucky that that will always be the case?
We certainly are. And such a pleasure as always speaking with you, Helen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Helen Pitt's book is called Luna Park, The Extraordinary Story of the Showmen, Shysters and Schemers Who Built Sydney's Famous Fun Park. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. The producer was Jennifer Leake. Executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.